Hello and welcome to the IA School of Thought series with me, Sai Kamal. School of Thought is our weekly show on classical liberal thought, looking at different strands of thought within classical liberalism, discussing some leading classical liberal thinkers, and applying some of these ideas to current issues. This show was inspired by the IA book, School of Thought, 101 Great Liberal Thinkers, which provides a clear and concise introduction to classical liberal ideas, profiles the lives and ideas of some of the leading thinkers on individual liberty from ancient times to the present day, outlines key elements of liberal thought and takes a look at these thoughts over the centuries, identifies where classical liberals agree and differ, for example, on the extent of government involvement in our daily lives, and covers classical liberal views on politics, government, social institutions, capitalism, rights, liberty, and morality. I'm delighted to be joined today by the author of 100 Great Liberal Thinkers, Dr. Eamon Butler, who's also director of the Adam Smith Institute. But before we get started, please do check out our online content on the IEA YouTube channel. Also, don't forget to subscribe to our new IEA Daily Bulletin to make sure that you don't miss out on any of our fascinating and thought-provoking content. So Eamon, welcome, and thank you for joining me today.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Can we just start off with some start at the beginning, as it were? What inspired you to write the book?
Well, I've done a long series, some with the Institute of Economic Affairs, of course, on liberal thinkers, Adam Smith and Ludwig von Mises, to name a couple. Because I think it's very important for people who maybe don't know too much about the liberal tradition to have an introduction to it that is very simple, straightforward to understand. It's not academic or full of jargon and things like that. And then I thought, well, having done all those, really there are hundreds and hundreds of liberal thinkers who've contributed to the liberal idea. Isn't it about time we just had a quick guide to some of those? So I started going through them, and before long I'd got up to 101.
And was it that you got up to 101, or did you have many more and you had to decide who made the cut? Did you have some sort of criteria, as it were?
Yes, I think that there were quite a number that you could have included. Deirdre McCloskey, who is in the book, she suggested several to me, like Peter Delacourt, who's a 17th century Dutch a trader, but he wrote about free competition, or Sir Dudley North, same sort of time, writer on free trade. Edmund Burke you might include. He's very much the conservative, but it had some liberal ideas. You might have included Thomas Sowell and modern Austrians like Peter Betke and Larry White and Virgil Storr. So, and now there's Geoffrey Brennan and James Otteson. There is no shortage of them. So I had to draw the line somewhere.
Has that given you ideas for, say, a sequel where you could do sort of 201 liberal thinkers? Or?
Well, it's not a bad idea, actually. Yes, also a RAND book. Yes, I could do that.
Well, given that I do commission books for the IA, maybe I'll be in touch about this afterwards. When you look at a text on thinkers over such a long time, you know, we have thinkers from ancient China, we have thinkers from the sort of golden age of Islam, we have thinkers right up to Friedman, and others who have relevance. You know, how does a text come in such a long time or time frame have relevance today?
Yes, well, I did it in date order. I could have done it by theme, because what you find in the liberal debate, which, as you say, has gone on for many thousands of years, that particular issues might come up and then they're parked for a couple of hundred years, and then they come up again and somebody else puts a new spin on it, and then some other idea comes up and the same happens to that. So doing it by sort of ideas wasn't, to me, as helpful as doing it as just a long tradition. But of course, you know, what unites all these people is their commitment to liberal ideas, to debating important questions like freedom versus the public good. Who decides what is the public good, and how do they decide it? And does that give them the right to override our personal freedoms? The nature and limits of rights, do they exist at all? Are they given to us by government, or are they something that we have by virtue of the fact that we're human beings? How to prevent people in power, in authority, gaining too much power and abusing it? These are the sorts of issues which all of these thinkers grappled with, and I think they're extremely relevant to today.
I noticed that you call the book liberal thinkers as opposed to, say, classical liberal thinkers. Now, of course, when we think about the terms that many classical liberals use to describe themselves, some use libertarianism, some use classical liberal, some think, well, actually, classical liberal sounds ancient, and no one's going to really feel it's relevant to today. Are you concerned about the use of the word classical liberal, or have we found the right word to describe those of us who believe essentially in liberty and freedom?
Yes. Originally, I did have it down as 101 classical liberal thinkers, but that got to be a rather complicated title. So we cut it down to 101 liberal thinkers. Now, that does, of course, confuse Americans, because in America, a liberal tends to be on the left. They're certainly in favor of individual freedoms, but they also believe that government has authority in the economic sphere and should indeed use economic intervention in order to increase equality and things like that. So really, in American terms, it means left winger. So you're stuck. If you're a classical liberal, everybody thinks, oh, well, we've moved on since John Locke, don't give me all that old stuff. And you're stuck. So actually, I mean, at the Amsmith Institute, we call ourselves neoliberals. And that, again, is a term which the left has taken up to be used as a term of pure abuse, really, without any content at all. But we thought, if we can't be liberals and we can't be classical liberals, we're going to be neoliberals. Our liberalism is a new liberalism. We take the same principles that all of these people have taken for the last 2,000-3,000 years, but we apply them to modern problems and we come up with new solutions. So I'm happy with neoliberal, but liberal for shorthand. And I think we really ought to recolonize the word liberal. Let's have a fight with the Americans on this.
And when I speak to some Americans, they say, well, actually, they're quite comfortable with the word libertarian. Whereas for some reason, Brits are less comfortable with the word libertarian. We seem to associate it with sort of drugs, guns and porn, don't we, for example?
Well, that's also true, of course, and actually it is true in America, I'd have thought, probably even more, that I think here, probably in the UK, that people don't quite understand what libertarianism is or means, whereas in America, partly because there is a Libertarian Party, so people have seen libertarians giving political speeches and so on, then I think partly in America, yes, they do think it's free sex and drugs and all the other stuff. And what it is about is, in fact, personal freedom and having the very smallest government you possibly can. In their case, I think probably preferably none at all. But liberals think that you do need some government to guard people's rights and to provide them with justice and defence, and that's very important.
So we're speaking during a pandemic. We're both in lockdown, as our fellow countrymen. We're seeing erosions of our liberties in many ways. Many of us are making choices not to go out, but we're being told that we can't go out. We've seen the massive government intervention in many countries, using large amounts of taxpayers' money. How are classical liberals supposed to respond to it? Is it inconsistent for classical liberals to support some of the measures that the governments are taking to combat COVID-19? Or do we just say, well, these are extraordinary times, and even in extraordinary times, there's consensus around the fact that there should be some government intervention?
Well, I think that liberalism is really a philosophy or a way of life for normal circumstances. I think emergencies are something different. And I think that certainly in America, there's been some pushback with people saying, no, we're not going to obey these lockdown laws because the Constitution guarantees our rights and says that we don't have to obey that sort of ruling. And I think even in the UK, the British government was very reluctant to go to a lockdown, precisely because it recognised that we're a liberal country, more or less, and that we value our freedom, and that the idea of the government telling us we've all got to stay indoors for 3 weeks or even 6 weeks or even longer is a difficult one.
So let's talk about sort of some of the political Sorry, did I interrupt you?
Well, I was just going to say, in a liberal society, I think you get more trust in government than you do in an authoritarian society. And therefore, I think actually people are much more likely to conform with the radical sorts of interventions that we've had here. So the trust in government, I think, is quite an important element. Even Hayek, the great F.A. Hayek, said that you need, in emergencies, it's different, that you need state intervention in emergencies. And a liberal government doesn't have to force people into these sorts of measures. They do it because they recognise, this is the right thing to do. And so I think as long as people know that it is temporary, and this is why there's such an importance about having a debate on how we get out of this lockdown, now we're in it, as long as people know it's temporary, they're prepared to put up with it. But it's when the rules are carry on the statute book and then they're used for purposes that they weren't intended, that's when you get trouble.
So let's talk about that as we kind of do re-emerge at some stage from a lockdown. You know, clearly there is consensus in terms of some government intervention and the role and using taxpayers' money. How can classical liberals regain the ground in the battle against big government state interference, especially where governments may be tempted not to repeal some of the measures that they put in place?
Well, I think that firstly, we succeed because we got better ideas. Our ideas actually work and they don't lead to all sorts of unintended consequences, that freedom does actually deliver the goods. It delivers a more prosperous society and a more equal society, believe it or not. So we've got everything going for us. I think in this, and of course, as you know, we know, there's a long, long tradition of liberal thinking and liberal debates. Liberalism, comes and goes, but it's always there. And it's been there, as you say, since ancient times. And in the present circumstances, I think that people are going to be looking for more freedom. They're going to be saying, look, you know, we're trying to grow a new business, or we're trying to revive a business that's been driven nearly to bankruptcy. We're loaded with all of these rules and regulations and all of these taxes. You know, couldn't we just do without those for a while? You know, even a temporary holiday, I think, would be so much appreciated. So I think that we need to play to those sort of sentiments, that the government has, the regulations and taxes that we have actually stop people from innovating and coming up with new ideas, new ways of delivering goods and services. And when you are in a recessionary position, a deep recession quite probably, you need that kind of innovation and that kind of ingenuity. Otherwise, you'll never get out of the hole.
I suppose while there have been concerns about some of the understandable restrictions on our civil liberties during this time, there's also been some light in terms of, if you think about the sort of hashtag Never Needed campaign, where governments have repealed some legislation. And for example, you know, who knew that restaurants weren't allowed to offer takeaways and they actually needed specific permission for that? You see that in the US as well. So there's some hope there, isn't there, if we could sort of continue to have those laws repealed?
Yes, I think it's been very revealing. And, you know, the alcoholic beverages wholesalers had to campaign to the government to say, well, we've lost our restaurant trade, you know, can we deliver direct to supermarkets? And you think, why shouldn't they be able to get
exactly,
yeah, the supermarket? And the same is true with food, right? Well, you've got all these wholesalers producing, you know, fish, meat, vegetables, and for various law rules, many of them EU rules on packaging and weight and labelling in particular, that they couldn't sell to the public and they couldn't sell to supermarkets. So you think that is crazy. And I think that more and more of those regulations have surfaced, and people have begun to think, and certainly politicians have begun to think, why do we need these regulations? So I think that departing from the EU in January is going to be a really useful time, because we can actually get rid of a lot of that we now know stands in the way of a much more flexible economy.
Okay, well, let's go to the book itself, the 101 Great Liberal Thinkers. Which ones were your particular favourites, or which ones have you been inspired by for a long time?
Well, I think, you know, my particular favourite has got to be John Lilburn, who lived, he was born in 1614, so it was about that time. And he was called Freeborn John because he insisted that individuals were born free and that you had no right to remove their freedom. And in those days, if you wanted to publish a paper, a pamphlet, saying even that, then you had to get permission from the so-called Stationers' Company, which was, of course, a state apparatus designed for censorship, so that nothing seditious could be published. But he published anyway, and for that he was taken in front of the Star Chamber, which was the sort of secret court of the time, and he refused to bow to the judges because he said that you're doing my job, I'm doing mine, I don't see, we're equal, I don't see why I should have to bow to you. And he also demanded to know what the charges were against him, which was another outrage, and he refused to sign a piece of paper incriminating himself. So for these things he was whipped and put in the pillory. But even in the pillory, he kept handing out pamphlets to the public. For that, he was put in jail. And then when he eventually came out, he joined the parliamentary forces. But then he criticised them for their religious intolerance. And he said that parliamentarians were living far too well in great luxury. And for that, again, he was exiled. And when he returned from exile, before it was supposed to be due, he was promptly put in prison again. So, there is a man who spent years and years in prison and suffering awful punishments simply to make the point that we are free human beings and that nobody has any right to boss us around, particularly if they're an absolute monarch and they do it arbitrarily.
Yeah, well, I mean, hugely inspirational, and as you say, and paid the price. Are there any others that you want to point out, or?
I think there are many others. I mean, John Priestley, for example. I mean, everybody knows him as the discoverer of oxygen. He was a brilliant scientist, but he also wrote. But he was also a nonconformist. He didn't take the state Church of England a religion, like many other nonconformists, he found himself barred from public office and barred from universities and things like that. But he did a lot of work on individual freedom, and in particular identifying political rights, which is the rights that you get from your political body, what the political body grants you in terms of voting and things like that. And civil rights, which are, if you like, the sort of natural rights that we have simply because we're individuals. So there, I think, is another interesting character that's often overlooked because people think of him as a scientist and not as a liberal thinker.
Well, there we are. There were two of your 101 liberal thinkers. Eamon, can I thank you very much for writing the book? I know a number of people have read it and been inspired by it and actually learned a little bit about their favorite thinkers. We had an internal competition in the IA for people to identify their favorite liberal thinkers. And this has actually inspired this series, which we are going to be running every week, interviewing individuals both in the IA and outside the IA about their favorite liberal thinkers and trying to learn a bit more about the individuals and the context of their time and their ideas. Thank you very much for joining us today. Anyone who wants to read the book, 101 Liberal Thinkers, can find it on the IA website. Thank you to all of you for watching today. For more information on the history of pandemics, the economic and regulatory impact of coronavirus, and much more, please visit www.iea.org.uk, check out our YouTube channel, and subscribe to our IA Daily Bulletin to stay updated on all our activity. And Eamon, once again, thank you very much for joining us today.
Welcome.